This week on Family Anatomy, Anatomy of Parent-Child Relationships.
Hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologists. So if you want to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Hello and welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spizzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. You can find us at familyanatomy.com or on iTunes. And we're once again talking with Dr. Mate today. It's part two of our interview. Do yourself a favor right now before you listen to this one, though. Go back and get part one because this guy, I find him fascinating to talk to.
Well, he's a great speaker, really. And we, as we mentioned before, he's a physician.
Yep.
He practiced for 20 years, sold his practice, and is currently working at the Portland Hotel in Vancouver.
That is correct what you just said.
Yes, it is. Once again, I was correct twice.
You were correct twice. And it's not actually a hotel. It's a residential treatment facility for adults with mental health or addiction issues, right?
That's right.
Now, I am correct.
You're correct as well.
I just wanted you to say that.
Once in a while, he's correct.
Every so often.
Gentlemen.
Every so often, it all works out. So we were lucky enough to see Dr. Mate in the fall down in Toronto where he was giving a talk. And I have to say, if you're listening to this now, if Dr. Mate comes to your town, go see him because he is really, he's fascinating to hear from.
I mean, he's an author. He's written four different books.
And my favorite, of course, is, well, one that he's co-written actually, but because it's more focused on parenting, is called Hold On to Your Kids.
That's
Why
right.
Parents Need to Matter More Than Peers.
That's a very good book. His most recent book is In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. But when we saw him in Toronto, Dr. Brian is right. If you have a chance to see him, it's be well worth your while. It's a unique presentation workshop because he invests himself in the workshop, meaning that he brings his own experiences to the workshop. He believes something I believe as well, that you know, when we talk about how we're treating adults and children as though there's just this one section of a segment of the population that has these kinds of symptoms and difficulties, but really we all have some aspects of these things, and he brings that to his talks. He talks about how he himself has had ADHD, mm-hmm. how he himself has had some form of addiction. And so it's not just him giving a kind of detached talk about something. He really infuses himself into the lecture and the workshop, and he gets a lot of participation from the audience as well.
It really makes it more real. It makes it hit home, I think, some of the things that he's saying with his own stories about his past and with the audience involvement where people are sharing some of their stories and he's kind of bringing those back to how your early experience and relationships might have influenced those experiences.
That's right. And he brings in some popular culture references into his talk as well.
Brain research. Now, we are all about research here on Family Anatomy, right? So he also has some research to back up some of the things that he talks about.
Lots of research, and I have to say that it's the type of research you don't hear a lot about. It's the type of research that talks about not just how genes affect your behavior, which is what you hear a lot about in the news, right?
Right.
It's more about how experience and biology interact,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Because his notion is that genes alone can't create the complicated kinds of behaviors that we see in people.
That's right. But if you read the newspapers and see the headlines, you'd think that genes are going to explain everything about human behavior. And they, of course, we've talked about this before. They use the word linked, mm-hmm. and that's all they have to do to write a story.
Exactly. So it is interesting to hear kind of the other side of that coin and to, well, really to understand that the situation is more complex than that. You can't just boil it down to a simple newspaper headline that this gene leads to this kind of problem. And I think as a result of those kinds of views, Dr. Matte's ideas are controversial in some circles, particularly I think about the ADHD issues. And he presents the notion that the parent-child relationship, your early experiences, have a major impact as you grow older, and problems like anxiety and depression and even ADHD are related to those early attachment experiences.
Right. But that they may have begun in those early ages, but that they're able to be transformed throughout your life. It's not something that you're necessarily stuck with.
Exactly. Yeah, he's a big believer and proponent of the idea that your experiences can change the way your brain is wired even.
That's right. And by doing that, you can have new relationships and better relationships with yourself and with others in your life.
Well, and he's certainly not the only person who feels that way about those early attachment experiences. When we talked to Dr. Valerie Wiffen about those hidden relationship problems that make women depressed, that's exactly what she was talking about, are those early attachment experiences and how, as adults, your expectations in relationships are based on those.
I mean, I think the whole idea of attachment really resonates with a lot of people. It's
obviously
resonating
for us. Yeah.
Well, it's resonating for us as professionals, but I think with the average parent out there, I think it resonates with them. They understand it, that their relationship with their child is very important. So,
Well, it's certainly time, I think, to talk about something that goes beyond the timeout that we hear about. And you watch Super Nanny or whatever those shows are called, and it's all about the timeouts and those limits and things like that. Well, it's nice to talk more about your relationship with your kids, I think, as opposed to your control over their behavior.
It's a big part of what makes your child feel secure and confident in themselves. And we've kind of left that out a little bit by talking a lot about behavioral strategies. But I think that's something that we'll let him explain a little bit more about right now.
Exactly. Let's get him on the phone.
Let's do it.
Right. And that situation with that limited emotional expression, I mean, we can also talk about bullying and how that plays in when people are vulnerable with their peer group.
Well, the bully automatically and instinctively attacks the vulnerability of another person in order to gain dominance. And that has to do with their own problem with vulnerability. So the bullies are actually very vulnerable people who have been hurt in that vulnerability, have shut it down, and now they make themselves feel better by attacking the vulnerability of others. And they're not even doing it deliberately. It's an automatic dynamic. But it has to do with their own negative experience. And so as that happens in the peer group, you get more and more bullying, which is exactly what we're seeing now.
So you talk about healthy reactions to stress that kids can have and what happens to kids when they're not able to respond to stress in healthy ways. Tell us more about what kids' options are in these situations and the ramifications of that.
Well, kids' options don't exist in a vacuum. Kids' options exist in the environment in which they exist and live. So when children are connected to nurturing adults with whom they feel safe, then they can express their feelings. If children have to shut down their feelings because the nurturing adults aren't available, or because the adults themselves are too stressed or too upset or they can't handle the child's feelings, or because the child has become too oriented to the peer group where expression of vulnerable emotion is not permitted, then that child is emotionally stuck. Now, being emotionally stuck then means that you're no longer expressing what it feels like for you, and that creates, as is articulated in another one of my books, When the Body Says No, that creates a long-term situation of stress, which then can undermine physiological health, so that physical illnesses like cancer and multiple sclerosis and arthritis and a whole range of other physical disorders are very much related to the non-expression of the so-called negative emotions, because the non-expression of those things undermine the immune system, because it turns out, again according to the latest research, not controversial but not taught in the medical schools yet, the emotional centers in the brain are completely connected with the immune system. So when you're shutting down emotions, you're also shutting down or confusing your immune system. I mean, if an infant is separated from mother, they should get anxious because the anxiety makes them cry out for the mother. And that anxiety then is a survival technique. So not a technique, it's a survival modality. So that attachment, when it's threatened, should induce anxiety in the person. Now, so it's an attachment alarm. It's a warning that the attachments are being threatened. Adults, when they're separated from people that they love, or you know, when they come to a new place, they don't know anybody, they feel anxiety. It's an attachment alarm. Much more so for the child, of course, who's completely dependent. Now, it follows that when people experience anxiety later on, it is usually a sign of disturbed attachments somewhere during the formative periods of their life. So when I see an adult with anxiety, I can pretty much tell what happened to them as kids.
And at the same time, though, parents are taught, I mean, many experts are teaching parents to use that attachment alarm against their kids in order to control their behavior or discipline them, right, through the use of timeouts and things like that.
Yeah, with a small child, you can make them anxious by threatening them exactly with what they're most afraid of, which is the loss of adult attachment. So when I threaten the child with the timeout, what I'm really saying to the kid is that I'm going to use your biggest fear, the loss of me and the relationship, against you. Now that works. It's a powerfully effective behavioral technique when you use it against 3 or 4-year-olds because they're so dependent on you and you scared them to death. It doesn't work on teenagers. And it stops working even with young kids after a while because the child's too troubled, it's too painful, they shut down against feeling the vulnerability of it, and then they say, I don't care, whatever. But if you use it successfully, what you really done is you taught the child that you're not there for them, what you disapprove of them, that your love and your acceptance of them is conditional. Therefore, all their lives they're going to be anxious around having to please other people. This is if you're successful.
So, you know, a lot of parents out there have heard, because it's very popular, behavioral theories are very popular, timeouts are very popular,
and well known.
So the
behavioral theories, first of all, they speak to the parent's frustration, because if the parent doesn't understand that the child's behavior arises from the troubled attachment with the parent, if the parent doesn't get that, then what do you got? Then you have a kid who's acting out and an anxious parent, and a parent who's frustrated. So these timeout and other punitive theories, they speak to the parent's frustration of, I've got to do something right now to get the upper hand. So the behavioral theories, they kind of feed into the parental fear and the parental frustration. What they do, of course, is that they make the relationship worse in the long term, and they make the problems worse, so that parents use a lot of that stuff in early childhood will have very troubled teenagers on their hands later on, but they don't know that.
Right, so for all the parents who have been using these timeout techniques and these behavioral techniques that they've been told by parenting experts to use, what would you say to them? What are their alternatives? How should they, because it's not too late for them to think of a different way to handle this.
Well, it's never too late. Fortunately, children are dependent on us, and even the teenager who is recalcitrant and oppositional and defiant still needs to depend on us. They just don't know it. But we can use that, in other words, we can use the child's need for us in a very positive way to reconnect with them and to give them that unconditional loving acceptance and to undo whatever damage we may have done. And certainly as a parent, I had to do that quite a bit. I had to do a lot of damage control later on, or not control, but really go back on what I'd done as a parent because I wasn't conscious of these facts and relearn how to parent.
And some of those things that you talk about, some of those ways to reestablish that unconditional loving relationship are sort of related to the things that parents do with their infant children.
We do it instinctively with children, with infants, because children are still sweet enough, or infants, I should say, are sweet enough and cute enough that they want to, and they want to connect with us. They're desperate to connect with us. So they make themselves very friendly to us. And that triggers our parenting instincts. Later on, when children become peer-oriented and they're pushing away from us, they no longer trigger our parenting instincts. They trigger our anxiety and our frustration and our resentment. And then we parent from those places. So actually, parenting is really about reconnecting with your instincts.
So there's a real focus usually on parenting techniques, right? And you're talking more about the attachment relationship. Is there...
We're saying that parenting is not a matter of techniques. It's not a role. It's not a skill. It's actually a relationship. If the relationship is working, the skills and the techniques, they come automatically. If the relationship is not working, then no skills and no techniques will work.
Now, for those parents who don't have infants anymore and have kind of strayed away from that, how do they reestablish a connection and a kind of a positive, secure attachment with, say, their teenager?
Well, the answer to that depends very much on the state of the relationship and the nature of the teenager, but I can only recommend that people read the book, Hold On To Your Kids, which is really about that. And it comes down to putting the relationship ahead of every other consideration. Relationship is more important than homework, than behavior, than anything else. And so that if parents get that, and if they gather the child back under their wings, then they can exert once more a positive influence on the child's behavior. It can be done. The more alienated and the older the teenager, the more challenging that work becomes. But it's almost never impossible. Because kids, believe me, I've talked to a lot of adults in my practice as a family physician and therapist who, even at age 35 and 40 and 50, are still wanting to have a good relationship with their parents. So it can always be done, but it takes a lot of work, a lot of patience, and it takes faith in your value to that child. And it also takes not taking the kids' behaviors personally, because they're not personal to you. They're a cultural manifestation of dynamics the child can't help, and which you couldn't help that either because you didn't know anything about it. So it takes letting go of guilt and shame and blame and just staying present with the kid.
I mean, that's a really important thing too, because I think people can listen to some of what you're saying and mistakenly start to think about how guilty they are. Well, shouldn't say mistakenly. It's a natural response, but let's say it's not a helpful response, and you're trying to get them to look at responsibility as opposed to guilt.
Yeah, you can take responsibility for something without loading yourself with a lot of guilt about it. And guilt is a useless commodity, as far as I'm concerned. We all feel it naturally. It's just part of our makeup, but it's not particularly helpful. And it's one thing to recognize that, as I have, for example, that the way I lived my life when my kids were small, as a workaholic daughter, emotionally not very present for them, that had a negative impact on their development. And therefore, if I want to help them later on, I need to connect with them. And I need to take responsibility for how I've been. It's the one thing to recognize that. It's another thing to load myself with a lot of guilt and debilitating shame about it. I did my best. Every parent does. It's a question of recognizing the importance of attachment, but not making yourself feel wrong or bad about what you may have done at a time when you didn't know any better. And not only that, as you pointed out earlier, the culture reinforces all kinds of negative techniques and attitudes because of the dominance of behavioral psychology, which was developed in rats in a laboratory. You can make a rat in a laboratory do anything you want by either sticking them with a needle or putting them in cold water or giving them sugar to drink. So, but that doesn't apply to human beings very much.
Right. You don't need to have a relationship with the rat.
You don't, but by the way, the studies are very clear that when you do provide rats with the right relationships, they do a whole lot better. their brains develop better, they're happier, they're smarter. So even with rats, relationships and environment makes a huge difference. But certainly it's not a question of transferring rat psychology to human beings and hoping to make it work.
Now, what about those parents who have younger kids? Is there a way to prevent these problems from happening, you know, to use that relationship?
Yeah, well, parents with younger kids need to get that the most important factor in their children's development is not how many programs they drive the kid to, not how many friends they introduce the child to, not how many smart toys they buy them, but just the quality time that they spend with them, one-to-one.
What parents often are doing is inviting the enemy into their home, right?
Well, yeah, for young kids, you know, little kids at 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, they should have no sleepovers. They shouldn't have play dates. You know, they spend the whole day with each other already in daycares and schools and kindergartens and nursery schools. Why do it on the weekend as well? These children need lots of adult contact. That's much more important for them than more peers and more friends. That's not going to help them in the long term. They'll make those friends on their own anyway when the time comes. What they need in their developmental years or strong, nurturing, emotionally present, non-stressed parenting contact.
part of what you're saying, because you know, you see nowadays we don't have the same extended family to sort of guide you in your parenting like we used to. So there's a lot of parents that are new that think to themselves, well, I don't know how to do this. Where do I find the skills? And I guess what you're saying is go back to your instincts.
Well, a lot of parents have gut feelings. They just don't pay attention to them. A lot of parents who use timeouts, their guts are screaming not to do this. A lot of parents will let their baby sleep through the night, suffer when they do. Mm-hmm. They should pay attention to themselves. Their gut feelings are right. And, you know, I think what they need to do is to consult the child developmental literature rather than the behavioral literature. So don't listen to those experts who tell you to separate yourself from your kids as a way of controlling their behavior. Just don't listen to that. You know, there's lots of good books, including the ones that I helped to write or wrote personally, that help give people the right information. Get that information. Don't listen to the so-called experts. They truly don't know what they're talking about.
And it really sounds like one of the things that parents need to do is to look after themselves and control their own stress level in order to be present for their kids.
Well, that's the other thing. That if when I was keeping myself a workaholic doctor, how could I be present for my kids? I was so stressed and my mind was always somewhere else. What presence could I provide to my children? So that you really have to live a life. See, most parents, if you ask them, what is the greatest value, what is the most important core commitment that you have, they'd say it's the happiness and well-being of my children. But if you look at how we live our lives, is that how we live? So there's a huge disconnect between what we believe we are committed to and how we live our lives. You need to bring the two into alignment. If I had known that when my kids were small, if I had had the insight to recognize it and the courage to deal with it, believe me, I could have spared my kids a whole lot of issues later on. And so parents do have to ask themselves that question.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about oppositional defiant disorder in kids. You have a unique perspective on that. What can you tell parents about that?
Well, first of all, just because the medical profession comes up with a diagnosis, it doesn't mean that they're describing anything real. In other words, there are kids who behave in an oppositional way, but does that mean they have a disorder? We're saying no. I'm saying that oppositionality is not something that can happen in isolation. If I'm going to oppose somebody, they have to be there. In other words, oppositionality has to do with their relationship. Nobody can be oppositional in themselves, can they? You can't be oppositional in a room by yourself. So in order to understand oppositionality, we need to look at their relationship, not just label the child with the category.
So instead you look at that concept of counter-will, right?
We're looking at anybody's, including the child's, natural resistance to being coerced, to being pushed on. As soon as anybody pushes on me, I push back automatically. So do you, so does everybody. Which is what my friend Gordon Neufeld calls counter-will, which is the automatic resistance to any sense of coercion. And what mitigates counter-will, what mitigates that resistance is relationships. So the better the relationship, the less automatic oppositionality. So the kids who are experiencing the dynamics that then we label as oppositional defiance are in fact just kids who've lost their attachment relationship with adults, and they perceive themselves as being pushed on by adults. Now, we're not going to solve the problem by pushing harder or by punishing them or by medicating them. We're going to solve the problem by rebuilding the relationship and instead of coercive techniques to bring them on side, to give them a sense of support and connection. So again, something which is a natural response, this resistance to coercion, becomes magnified in the absence of a nurturing relationship. And there you have the oppositional defiant kid. But it's not his problem. It's the problem of the relationship with the adult world, which we can then turn around.
That's interesting perspective on that. And I think you have another interesting perspective on ADHD. I know that about 2-3 years ago, a fairly large famous study came out about using medication with ADHD and how over the course of, I think it was 7 years, they followed these kids. And what they found was that the outcome for them, once they went off the medication, that didn't seem to help whatever difficulties they were having initially. So while they were on the medication, they were good. But once they came off it, even after 7 years of being on it, it didn't seem to have a long-term effect.
Well, of course not, because medications don't change anything. They only suppress symptoms. if you have asthma, and if I gave you a cough suppressant, I can suppress your cough, but I haven't changed your asthma, have I? So that you got to deal with the fundamental dynamics. And what I'm saying is that ADHD is not a disease. It's a problem of development because of stressed early environment. The solution is not to simply medicate these kids, but to help them develop. And medications on their own don't promote development. They simply suppress symptoms. So if you're going to use medications, by all means, go ahead, but understand its limitations. So the real solution to the ADHD problem is, how do you help this child mature? How do you help those brain circuits develop that didn't develop so well in the first place? Well, how you do that is in the context of the nurturing relationship. So my book on ADHD, Scattered Minds, is all about recognizing that this condition is not a disease but a developmental issue, and that if we're going to help these kids grow up, we're going to help them develop. And how to do that is the subject of the book. In that context, you may find medications helpful, or you may not, but they're not the issue and they're not the answer. And it's not surprising, of course, at the end of 7 years, if all that happens, which usually is all that happens, is that the child gets medication, there's no development. Why would there be?
It confuses parents because some of the people looking at that research responded to it by saying, we need to keep children on the medication longer beyond their teen years, and even bring it down younger than 4 and 5 years of age, because it's an illness. It's the kind of thing you need insulin. It's the same kind of idea. You wouldn't just stop the insulin.
Well, what can I tell you? If you live in a certain mindset, all the solutions that you're going to come up with are a flow from that mindset. If you think that ADHD is an inherited genetic disease and the only solution is medications, then any resolution you're going to come up with will have to do with medications. If you understand that it's a developmental problem, then you will be promoting brain development, which is what I'm talking about. So it's a question of where you're coming from. Again, you see, the problem is I understand their perspective, and I've taken medications myself, and they've helped me, and I'm not against them, but they don't understand my perspective because they never thought in those terms. So they can only think in terms of narrow pharmacology. That's what they can do. You can't blame the poor souls, but they're stuck in that world.
Obviously, both Brian and I are interested in your views and agree with many of your views, but do you get a lot of resistance to your views from the general establishment?
There's no establishment. There's just a bunch of people out there with different points of view. What can I say? My books are bestsellers. People obviously embrace them. I get a lot of invitations to speak to psychologists and occasionally medical doctors as well. When I do, the people hear me respectfully and I don't get much resistance. Mostly what it is not resistance to me personally or to my ideas. It's a lack of awareness of them because the mainstream mindset doesn't take into account the latest information on neuroplasticity, the capacity of the brain to develop, on epigenetics, which is how genes are affected by the environment, on brain development, how childhood brain development is shaped by the environment. All these scientifically established facts are simply outside the realm of mainstream medical thinking because they haven't yet been taught to medical students and still are not. So it's not so much resistance as just a lack of awareness.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to provide some of that information to our listeners today and increase awareness of this point of view about the importance of those early attachment experiences. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure. And if I may just say in conclusion that if people want more information, they can certainly check out my website, www.drgabormate.com, where they can read not only about my books, but they can also link to various lectures and interviews that I've done available on the internet that they can then view on podcasts and so on. So if people want more information, that's where they can get it.
Listen, thank you very much, Gabor, for this interview. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
My pleasure as well. Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. So get up and sing. It's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do. FamilyAnatomy.com